Welcome to the Youth Critic Retrospectives on the Youth Critic Network. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Youth Critic Podcast. I'm your host, Kale Smith. Joining me this week is David Weiser from Film Assessment.
Hey, everybody.
And David, what movie are we talking about this week?
Mank.
It's a modern day version of Coyote.
Orson Welles. Houseman tells me we have you just where we want you.
I understand we've 90 days.
Let's aim for 60.
He's just got a month.
May. So we are here, David, this is the 200th episode of the podcast. And without any, you know, celebration or party, let's just get right into Mank. What did you think of Mank?
I really enjoyed it. I thought the craft behind it was great. And just like how it was made it like an old movie in like the 30s, like a old talkie.
Mm-hmm. And what I loved about Mank was I think I love more its structure and more of like its surprise. I think more people were coming into this movie thinking that this was going to be about the making of Citizen Kane, mm-hmm. but through the eyes of the co-screenwriter. And it's sort of about that, but it's more about the writing and the controversy around it, sort of. Mm-hmm. And to go into it, Mank is very much about the story of Herman J. Mankiewicz and him writing the first draft of Citizen Kane. You know, in the movie and in the story, the first draft was titled American. I think that's what it was. It was America or American. And you know, during this time, we get the story of, like, what was the inspiration of Citizen Kane, which is, of course, William Hearst and his wife. So we're following the story of Herman J. Mankiewicz as he's in a, you know, downward spiral with his alcoholism, but also his unwillingness to support Hearst and Louis B. Mayer. They're kind of like sabotage of the election, the California election of 1934. But on the other hand, but as the story unfolds, you realize he basically gave them the idea of how to win that election. And how now a lot of people, you know, try to win elections nowadays. And that's really the political aspect of it. It's a movie about now, but it's also a movie about the 30s. And to say that it's an interesting piece from David Fincher is pretty slight. Moving to you, David, what was some of the more surprising aspects of the movie?
There's a certain cameo I did not see coming, and I was like, is that who I think it is? I don't know if we want to go into spoilers or not, but you probably know who I'm talking about. The person who plays who's the author, the politician?
Upton Sinclair.
Yeah, the person who plays Upton Sinclair. I did not see that coming. that was probably the biggest shock for me. And I was just like in awe. I was like, this person is in a David Fincher movie. That's kind of amazing.
To be fair, David Fincher really does cast. I mean, he's the guy that cast Tyler Perry in Gone Girl in a very good role.
And they're all good castings. I was just saying, it just took me off guard because I didn't expect to see it in the movie. If we want to go into saying who it was, we can. But if we want to wait and talk about it later,
let's hold off a bit. So, for me, getting into Mank, and it's, well, to be fair, the movie's been out for a couple of weeks on Netflix, so I think we're okay with spoilers.
Okay, so Bill Nye the Science Guy is in a David Fincher movie, and that's just incredible to me. But on the note of what you were just talking about involving like the corruption of the election and like kind of the propaganda that Mank inspired, I liked the scene where his friend that was ended up directing the short was left alone in the office, and he had to deal with the ramifications of giving that idea to the executive, where the person left alone in the office ended up killing himself. But he went and tried to stop him, but he didn't know that he had extra bullets.
Yeah, and that's
just like really intense, and just like you feel like he feels responsible for it on multiple accounts because of the fact that he was the one that kind of led to that crisis of conscience for the his friend that ended up directing it. I don't remember the character's name.
Shelley.
Shelley. And then the fact that he wasn't able to stop him when he thought he did, you know, like he wasn't thorough enough.
Well, I mean, you also see the regret on Mank's face as the election night continues in the earlier scene through that incredible montage of just like the boos, the people laughing, the celebrating the rise of Frank Merriam's rise in the polls. So you see like him in despair afterwards, but it really hits him, you know, right after, you know, he sees Shelley, and Shelley, I mean, just poor Shelley, he just realizes he basically has ruined California and probably all of, you know, America's hopes forever. You know, and it's, and on top of that, the guy has Parkinson's. So he's like, I've ruined America. And I'm just, you know, and I have Parkinson's. Like, it's not good. And yeah, I mean, and that's what Mank is in a way trying to, in this story, upend. He's trying to do better with this script of, he's trying to amend his sins through the script of Citizen Kane or American. That's what he's trying to upend, and he wants credit, and that's why in the end he wants credit. I know we're jumping around a little bit, but that's kind of where the movie is heading. And I think it's an incredible way of revealing the story of Citizen Kane. I mean, and I'm sure there are stories from the set that are interesting and whatnot, but the real compelling narrative is Mankiewicz and his, you know, and what he was thinking of while writing. And to me, that's an intriguing insight into the story.
Mm-hmm. And I really liked his, platonic chemistry with both Marion Davies and then Rita Alexander in the present day timeline as she was taking care of him. Like, they had a really sweet dynamic.
Well, the thing about Rita is it feels like Rita is the classical Hollywood story. Like, she has the boy, she has the fiance in the war, and she finds out her fiance is in, you know, her fiance's, you know, ship was sunken near Norway or wherever, and then you find, and then you find out later that there is a happy ending. She represents kind of what we are assuming of Hollywood, what we want out of the Hollywood story, the ups and downs of a Hollywood story. And she, and the reason why her chemistry is so great is because she is just opposing the kind of reality that Mank is living, which is the corruption is doing everything they can to stop American from happening, essentially.
Yeah, and then I like how it's very much the similarities in the structure between Mank and Citizen Kane, and how it's kind of like a reversal, where Citizen Kane, the flashbacks kind of give you kind of context of who Kane was. Here, it's kind of like a reversal in the sense of the flashbacks give you context for the inspiration behind, like, the supporting characters who give their account of experiences with Kane. But here, it's basically Mank's recollections that are kind of fuzzy because, you know, he's alcoholic, of his recollections of those people and experiences with those people that inspired those same characters.
Absolutely. And it's those, but it's those experiences we learn the most about them. And through, and we get to see, you know, one of the most important scenes in the movie is we get, so after Louis B. Mayer introduces Joseph Mankiewicz, his brother Joe, to, he introduces Louis to Joe, and then they start that cool, like, walking shot that under the camera, you know, that camera pan up of, you know, Louis, you know, talking about, like, I spent $1 million on scripts we don't even make. And then he goes, you know, in front of the, you know, in front of the lower tier, you know, the bottom tier people of MGM and tells them we have to cut wages for 8 weeks and or whatnot. The reason why that scene is so important is it shows you how manipulative these people are, like how manipulative people like Louis B. Mayer are. Like, they can play the family harp like they're in a drama play and gain sympathy of the people. But in the end, I mean, they're still going to spend millions of dollars on stuff that, you know, they don't need. They're not really saving money. They're just, you know, saving money to not, you know, have to, you know, cut other things, but from the other people. And I think that's kind of the lot. And I think that's kind of the thesis. If there was a thing that I like to call the thesis statement or the thesis scene of a movie, that scene is the thesis scene.
Yeah, and the movie kind of has like a, it seems like it has a very much a love-hate relationship with the old Hollywood, where it's very much a scathing critique of the studio system at that time. But it, at the same time, like, the way the movie is made in the vein of an older movie, there's very much a love for that style of filmmaking, like the actual filmmaking of the era. But the studio system behind it, like, and all the machinations and everything, is where it's more of a scathing critique.
I think that's why I would say it's more of a hate relationship, because Venture might love the filmmaking behind Citizen Kane and all of those older talkies at the time, but he doesn't, and I think this is true of Venture pretty much in general, he hates the studio system. Mm-hmm. He hates that kind of conservatism of the studio system that, you know, that cap, he, I always get the sense that Fincher, you know, doesn't like the capitalistic nature of studio system and how it always undercuts the more important people. And I think that's why he, when Fincher says he goes to the studios and says, this is my budget, this is my, you know, this is a, you know, this is how much we're going to make it for. And the studio is like, cut, you know, we'll cut $1 million off or cut $10 million off of your, you know, $40 million budget or whatever. Fincher's like, no, and then walks away. I think the reason why Fincher is that kind of filmmaker is because he doesn't want to cut from anywhere else. Like, he, this is how much it's going to cost. This is how much it's going to cost to pay the people to make it. And we won't go under and we won't go over. And that's what, you know, and that's something I have always admired of Fincher, because I think he does hate the studio system, but he has to use it to make his movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where you get the begrudging, but also Fincher, but I think Fincher and his father, Jack Fincher, did a lot of research, as well as uncredited screenwriter for this project, Eric Roth. They did a lot of research on like what was happening in the time. And yeah, even though they did so much research, did you see or notice any that they got some of the things wrong in the movie?
I went and kind of looked at some articles about that, but I didn't like dig too deep. But I kind of don't mind that, because of the fact that, like I said, there's an unreliable narrator at the center of this. The protagonist, he's an unreliable narrator because he's an alcoholic, and he's clearly kind of jaded about everything and all these people around him that kind of betrayed him in a sense. And so it would make sense to me that those things would be skewed from his perspective.
Absolutely. Well, to be fair to Fincher and his crew, I mean, they were talking about doing, so everyone kind of points at the Wolfman, you know, comment in the scene where they're pitching like monster movies and whatnot. And to be fair to Fincher, Frankenstein was, I believe Frankenstein was released in the early 30s. And then they were in the Universal was in talks to do a Wolfman movie for a very long time. And then it got finally made in the early 40s. But you make a good point. It is an unreliable narrator. And all of the projects and stuff that Fincher and everyone brought up, or Mank brought up, they all eventually did happen before the current events of this movie, if that makes sense. Or they were at least talked about in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessary. So the timeline isn't that, it's not problematic. It's just A, the narrator might get his dates wrong. And then on top of that, like, it's stuff that wasn't necessarily released, but it was already being talked about by other studios about to get to May. Like, you know, I mean, years before Wizard of Oz got made, I mean, it was already being talked about as like this big Herculean endeavor. So anyway, that's my spill on that. What did you think of the music? Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross's score.
Beautiful score. And it's so, like I said, in kind of conjunction with everything else, in regards to the filmmaking, it's very old fashioned. It feels like a score for an older movie. And it feels like it kind of has that like flexibility in terms of like tone and style of the music, where it sometimes it's very like romantic in a sense. And then it'll like kind of be very urgent. Like there'll be like a sense of urgency to the music as well. And it's just so diverse, I guess. And it's just like this sweeping epic music. And I really love the score.
I love it too, because again, I mean, there's a comment that was made by Fincher a long time ago about Reznor and Ross and that, you know, that Fincher doesn't, you know, he doesn't like dictate what kind of music gets made by them. He just tells them what the scene is and what it, you know, and it's kind of like asking, he kind of relates it to asking Reznor, like, give me a version, your version of spa music. So in reference to this, I feel Fincher, Reznor and Ross has composed a score here that's very much in the vein of old movies, and it's very much their style, but it clearly has, but it has, you know, the sensibilities of the 1940s or the late 30s, early 40s, you know, style of music. And it even cues a lot similarly to Citizen Kane in a way. And that's kind of, and also it gives, you know, really nice soft, it's one of the more softer melodies that they have produced for a Fincher movie. Usually they're known for their like harsh experimental music. But for this one, they're very, it's a much more softer, especially when Marion Davies comes on. It's very clear they wanted, Ross and Reznor and Fincher kind of wanted for Davies, even in the scene where she kind of comes to try and talk Mank out of making, or, you know, going through with the script, she, you know, it's still very soft and very much like a love theme. It's still very, it still has all the elements of a good love theme, which, yeah, it's a really good score. I wonder what they're going to do for Soul. I know their score got
released. I've heard it's incredible, and I'm really looking. Yeah, I try not to listen to scores before I see a movie either, so I'm probably not going to, I'm going to wait till I watch Soul before I really dive into that score.
I try not to either. I can't remember which movie this year I saw that I actually went ahead and listened to like one or two cues. Oh, it's Tenet. I listened to like a cue or two from Tenet, and then I was like, no, I'll just wait. I'll wait till I see it. And then, and now I kind of listen to Goransson's score a lot. But that's beside the point. I can't wait to hear what they got for Soul. I know that's coming out this Friday. But, man, that's really quick turnaround. They did Soul and this, like, back-to-back.
Mm-hmm.
Usually they just do one a year or even just, you know, they just work with one director for that one film and then don't do a score for another couple of years.
Yeah.
The other scene that I feel is so, or the other relationship that I can't not mention is this between Marion and Mank. They have that nice scene where they kind of go through the entire like zoo of hearses.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and you know, and then and it's really nice, and it, you feel that love theme, and then that love theme comes back again when she goes to see Mank at the dry farmhouse or ranch, and that love thing comes in, and you still it's one of the more sweeter love stories without it being a love story. It's a platonic,
yeah, it's kind of like a, yeah, platonic love story, and it's like there's kind of like a tragedy there because like Mank probably wants it to be romantic in a sense, and but he knows it's never gonna happen. Even though, like, I did kind of look into a little bit about him, and, like, he never really, at least from what I found, is that his, like, affairs tend to be platonic. Like, kind of like the relationship he had with Marion Davies. That was kind of how he, from what I read, I don't know if this is 100% accurate, obviously, but, like, that was kind of how he was with other women, and his wife was obviously jealous and stuff, but, like, he didn't, is from what I looked into, he didn't like actually have an affair. Like it was all platonic relationships he had with various women.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think maybe Mank did want it to be, but it was never going to be. She loved Hearst. Maybe not when, you know, he was, and she's right, maybe not when he was the social security check, but there, she has a real love for him in that moment. And you just see the tragedy that unfolds. And you really do hope that either way, they'll forgive each other. And it's a good scene. And it's a good way, of exchanging lines. That whole, if this happens, I hope you'll forgive me. And then, you know, if it doesn't happen, I hope you'll forgive me. It's really great. And it's such a, like, Fincher, it's such a Fincher line. Like, I know Fincher doesn't write his scripts, but it feels very Fincher-esque to have that in there. And the, even the way it's, like, said and read and, like, you know, it just feel, it's a very Fincher thing to do in a movie that's kind of not as Fincher-esque as you would think.
Mm-hmm.
Because Fincher because Fincher's style is not old-fashioned at all.
No.
It's far from it. Fincher is all about, you know, new camera movements, CGI camera movements, you know, the camera always moves with the actors when they, you know, sit upright, you know, it, like, Fincher very much wants you to be in the headspace of the characters, but here, he restrains all of that. You don't move, the camera doesn't move with the actors hardly at all. It just is stationary the entire time. It's framed to where the characters are, where you just see the character sitting, but the camera doesn't move. If that makes sense. Like, it just, like, Fincher goes for it, and I think that might be a slight detriment in why some people are sort of, you know, criticizing it more because it doesn't feel as Fincher-esque. But the way Fincher made it, in knowing Fincher, it wouldn't have been made any other way. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I also don't want to forget to mention Charles Dance. I mean, I love him as an actor, and I thought he was great as William Randolph Hearst. And then, of course, Gary Oldman, he was fantastic. Amanda Seyfried, Lily, what's her last name?
Amanda
not
Seyfried?
Lily James. No, the girl that played is Lily Collins.
Right.
Mm-hmm. She was great as well. The dinner scene towards the end of the movie, like, I loved that sequence. That was class A acting from Gary Oldman, and then Charles Dance also.
Well, it's a great performance from everyone. I mean, even, let me look at the name. Even from, I'm trying to find it, Arliss Howard, who plays Louis B. Mayer, his soliloquy or rant toward his final word against Mank about him just making him feel small. And this, you know, this guy is a short guy in real life, but he's able to make Mank feel small through his words and through, like, his actual purpose and take him down a peg. And then you see William Randolph Hearst, who in the movie always looks old and sickly, but in that final moment, he looks almost vampiric. Like, it's kind of scary. Because, I mean, the way he just kind of walks him out and then closes the door on him, it's very, like, it's very freaky to, you know. And, Charles Dance always playing the villain and looking freaky-ish.
Yeah, he always has a very great screen presence that's very, like, commanding. And he's just, like, this, like, formidable person. And anytime he's on screen, like, love him as an actor.
Oh, yeah. And I think we would be remiss if we didn't talk about Orson Welles.
Oh, yeah. Whoever the actor was that played Orson Welles, I don't know off the top of my head.
It was, I'm looking up the IMDb, Tom Burke.
Okay, Tom Burke did a wonderful job as Orson. Like, I feel like he captured him so well, at least from what I know of Orson Welles and how I perceive him. I feel like he, like, nailed it. Like, and it didn't really seem, it was, like, the right balance between, like, an impression and, like, actually making it his own, I guess. And then I would say that something similar about Oldman as Mank, like, whereas he could have gone too far with the alcoholic aspect of it, and it could have come off as a little, like, cartoonish. I think he, like, played it, like, very well, to where there was, like, just enough, like, realism to it. And he didn't get, like, he didn't go too far over, like, trying to over-exaggerate on being, on his, like, obsession with alcohol and kind of, like, silly rants and stuff like that.
Well, what's great about Fincher's style is that it allows the actors to keep trying and trying different things. And so you have to understand, even for this movie, and this one wasn't that big of a budget, but they still had to do all of Fincher's, 100 takes, or whatever. But Fincher, for Oldman, I mean, he probably got it into his head to where he could figure it out. And I think Oldman himself is a former alcoholic. Don't quote me on that, but I think I've heard that once. That, he was an alcoholic and then he's been dried for a while now. So I think Oldman kind of carries from that, and then, he just brought it on, and it isn't cartoonish, but it's only not cartoonish because it's all in character. Like, there's nothing.
Yeah, there's very much like a pathos underneath it all. Like, you can tell there's like a tragedy to, like, what's happened to this man, this fall of Mink, even though, like, he was such a prominent name for a while in Hollywood, as a screenwriter, at least, in terms of, like, everyone would get him to involved on their projects, but then he just kind of ostracized himself, and then it just kind of ruined his reputation. And then Citizen Kane, obviously, while that is his masterpiece, it's kind of and at least in the eyes of Hollywood, it also kind of tarnished his reputation even more, because he was taking big shots at specific people like William Randolph Hearst and Louis P. Mayer, etc.
Absolutely. I mean, he still got his Oscar. Mm-hmm. But in the end, he made a movie that criticized Hollywood in a very subtle way.
But I
really have found this movie to be very likable, and even likable. So, do you remember Iron Fist?
Like the Netflix series?
Yes.
Yes.
So, the person who plays
His brother. Yeah.
Yes. Is in that show, and I really hated his performance in that show. Mm-hmm. So to see that this guy gets a role like this and does a fantastic job in it, it's just like even more damning towards that show. Yeah. Because it's like, Tom Belfry, like, I just didn't like his work at all. I thought it was just way too much. Way too much acting. But here it's like, no, it's really good. It's really, calculated, and he's perfect as that Mankiewicz brother, as the Joe Mankiewicz brother. So it was fantastic. That's what I'll say. I don't want to rip Iron Fist even more, because that show has been horribly horribly destroyed and lost mm-hmm. in the sands of time. But yeah. So I think I have to ask, because it's kind of come and go, but do you think Mank still has Oscar chances?
On technical levels, absolutely. I think David Fincher will be in contention for director. I don't know that I think it might be nominated for Best Picture. I don't know that it would win. I don't really know what categories it would really stand a chance at winning right now. But then again, I feel like there's a lot of award type movies I still haven't watched that either haven't been released yet, or they're like in such this weird release format, or like there's a lot of things release that went on limbo. VOD I didn't see. And yeah, I'm not really sure what to really compare it against yet. Like, I don't really know what the playing field is exactly. So I think it has some Oscar chances for, especially in the technical categories.
I think it does have, I think Gary Oldman has a chance. It all depends on how Netflix plays, because like every year, I think there will be a lot of choice. There's a lot of choices. I mean, obviously for Best Actor, Gary Oldman has sort of a lead, but then, you know,
he kind of Netflix is kind of competing with themselves there, because they have Delroy Lindo, and then they also have Chadwick Boseman, obviously, and it's kind of just like, well, you kind of gotta, I don't know, it's just a situation of like they've got to push all three of these people.
They have Boseman twice, because he's getting a lot of praise for Mulaney,
actor and supporting.
Mm-hmm.
Supporting for Defy Bloods, and then lead for Mulaney. I haven't watched that yet, but I'm gonna watch it soon.
I was about to say, because I have it queued to watch, but I haven't watched it yet. I was trying to see it in a theater, but it's going
theater
away
where
now.
I saw Mank was playing it the day after when I was leaving Mank, they were changing the marquee to add that on there. But I knew it would be on Netflix so soon, I wasn't necessarily in a rush to see it in a theater. I might try to go see it if they're still playing it. But at this point, if it's already on Netflix, I might just watch it on Netflix. I did get to see Wonder Woman early, so.
Everyone's been seeing Wonder Woman early. Well, I'll have to talk to you about that later. But yeah, so. I did see Mank in the theater. And did you see Mank on, I know you saw Mank in the theater, but did you see it at all, rewatch it on Netflix?
When I was writing my review, I went to certain scenes that I wanted to see again, just for context, because it's kind of nice to have that, being able to have it as a resource while you were working on it. But I didn't watch it all the way through a second time yet. I really want to. I didn't mention this earlier, but my first time watching it, like you were saying, I had this expectation in my head that it was going to be kind of like the making of Citizen Kane, kind of like the Disaster Artist. And when it wasn't that, I wasn't like disappointed or anything, but I was very much kind of lost in kind of the history of old Hollywood, so to speak. Like, I didn't know necessarily who a lot of those major players were and knew a lot about them. I had read The Jungle in English in high school, so I knew that much about Upton Sinclair, and I knew a little bit about him from history, and I knew a little bit about William Randolph Hearst, but I didn't know too much. And then I hadn't seen Citizen Kane till like the day or two before I went to go see Mank. Mm-hmm. And so I knew some about Orson Welles in general, and then I didn't really know too much about the making of Citizen Kane. I just knew, I just watched the film then, and then I did a lot of research after I watched the movie. And so I think it would play better for me on second viewing, understanding a lot more of those relationships and who these people were. Because like on first viewing, they were kind of being introduced to me as I was taking it in. And like, I feel like there's more to gain from it if you know the significance of who's who.
Well, the story that inspired Mank is the Pauline Kael Raising Kane article. And not to get into this too much because Royal Ocean Film Society did a great video on this. I'll put a link in that in the description below. But what Andrew was saying is that, you know, that article was about how Herman Mankiewicz wrote the story. Like, he basically wrote the script for Citizen Kane, and Orson Welles did none of the work. And this movie depicts that to a certain extent, but what Andrew countered was, and had great, you know, resources to counter it with. It wasn't just like he was trying to disavow or discredit Pauline Kael. Andrew's point was, what, you know, what Welles contributed to the script was condensing the script. As you may recall, in the movie, the script was over 200 pages long. I think the final count was about 230 for the script, for Mankiewicz's script. And even though RKO gave a lot of, you know, leeway to Orson Welles to make Citizen Kane, he still had to make a 2-hour movie. He still had to make, you know, a movie that was, that could be shown in theaters and not, you know, only just be shown once a day. So what Ort Welles did was he condensed the film and a lot of the events, particularly the events of Kane's first marriage, into one montage. So that's where Welles's, you know, contributions came into, was condensing the script. So while Mankiewicz created the story and deservingly got credit for it, or the arbitration for it, Welles is the one that basically edited the script to what it needed to a better length, and then did more trimming for the movie. And again, you can see a much better take on this with Andrew Saladino's video, but that's really the story behind the Mank versus Welles, which we only get to see the beginning of. It never goes anywhere. It's just the funny part is the thing that people actually came to see is all at the end of the movie, and we only get the glimpse of it. Mm-hmm. That's really the story I think people were wanting to see, but they didn't get, and maybe that's frustrating, but I don't know. I like the story we got, so.
Yeah, no, I absolutely do. I just think if I had known more about these people beforehand, I think I would have gotten more out of it.
Absolutely. And to be fair, I didn't know a lot about these people either. I didn't know who Irving was. I didn't know a lot about Louis B. Mayer. I didn't really know that much about William Hearst other than he was the basis of Citizen Kane. I felt like the movie did enough.
But then again, it did. It's just like, as it's happening, like, it's kind of like, I don't know. It's kind of hard to explain. It's like that, in terms of, I think it's like introducing the concept to you for the first time versus you already being acquainted with it. Mm-hmm.
To be fair to Fincher, this is still very much a film nerd's movie. But he does give I think he does give you enough. You just have to really invest in it. And invest in it a lot more than a Fincher than you would in a normal Fincher movie. Because Fincher, I think, in his films, I think does give you, he's not unsubtle, but he gives you a much better insight than he would here. If that makes sense. I think he's just tied a little too much to what his father wrote and didn't want to change a whole lot.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of beautiful he got to honor his father and by finally making his, like, script, you know?
Absolutely. Like,
yeah, it's kind of nice.
I kind of, you know, I haven't seen any interviews with Fincher on Mank yet, but I kind of wonder what his take is on all this. Like, now finally being able to do your dad's work and all this, like, I kind of wonder what his side of it all is. But then again, I haven't found any like exclusive interviews of Mank yet. I guess they're just, I guess Netflix is either waiting or Fincher is just like, no, let's just let the movie be.
The stuff I saw about Fincher doing press for Mank wasn't about Mank because like he made all these headlines regarding his takes on like Joker and Orson Welles. I saw those headlines, but I didn't really see any else, but I'm sure he did interviews.
I'm gonna have to keep looking because I did see those quotes too, and I think that is I don't know what your take on Joker is, but I think, you know, he's not terribly wrong.
Yeah,
I don't think he's wrong about Joker, but it is kind of funny that he's just like, you know, it's a disrespect to, you know, mentally ill people. Which I kind of agree with you, Fincher. I don't know what I'm saying. I wish that, you know, I wish there was more out there, but I guess there hasn't been a lot of chances lately. So with that said, I know we talked about the Oscar chances. Do you think this will be on your top 10? Or is it too early to say?
I'm not sure if... So I'm still kind of in conflict as to whether I should release a top 10 on, like, December 31st like I normally would. Because I feel like at this point of the year, I haven't watched enough to really truly say what my top 10 favorite movies of the year are. So I was thinking about waiting and doing it earlier in 2021 and maybe including some of those movies that are going to be in the 2021 awards contention, because those were meant to be 2020 releases. And so like I'm kind of at odds to how I should approach that, but for right now I will say it is in my top 10.
I will say this, I won't release a top 10 till either later next month or when it's all said and done, or when the Academy vote is done. I don't know if like movies like Cherry will count. I know Nomadland will count.
I did see a screener of Nomadland, but I was having issues with my Wi-Fi, so I had to watch it on my phone. So that was unfortunate, but I did get to watch it.
Wait, where did you get a screener?
The New York Film Festival. So they initially did a series of screenings that were virtual, and they kept selling out. And so I missed out on that wave. But then they did one like 2 weeks ago for like a period of a week where you could, but there were all these ridiculous restrictions for it where you could only access it for a like 4 hour window, and you had to complete the movie within that 4 hour window. And I hated that aspect of it, and it was only available for the day you purchased the rental. That's why I ended up having to watch it on my phone, because otherwise I was gonna lose out on the rental because I was having Wi-Fi issues.
I'm never gonna see Nomadland. Every time I, you know, hear
it releases in theaters in February, so
I don't know if I can wait. I keep wanting to see it because I'm like, you know, everyone that's seen it has said it's fantastic. And
I will say, I don't think I love it as much as the general consensus, but it's a beautifully made movie.
Okay. Well, that makes me feel a little better. But yeah, every time I keep, you know, hearing about a screener is getting available or whatnot, by the time I like get to it, it's already sold out. And
yeah, they were selling out ridiculously fast. It doesn't even make sense because it's a virtual screening. I don't understand why there's a capacity. I mean, I guess their servers can only handle so much. I don't know if that's what it has to do, but it's like, I don't know. I don't like the virtual screening system for film festivals and stuff.
Well, Atlanta Film Festival, we didn't have that problem of selling out screeners or anything like that. We did not. Granted, we didn't have Nomadland or any film that was anticipated like that, but we still had incredible pictures to watch. But I mean, it was, I don't even know if we even had a screening capacity for virtual screeners at the festival. I think it's kind of dumb. Like,
it is dumb. It doesn't make sense to me. Like, why are you limiting how many people can watch it if it's not a physical location? Like, if it's not a physical screening, it doesn't matter. And then I hated the time restriction of the screening as well. Like, that you have to watch it within this span, and if you don't finish it, we're gonna cut you off.
I mean, that's silly. I'm sorry. Searchlight Pictures, just release the movie on streaming and then put it in theaters later. I mean, Jesus. Or you know, if you do a festival screen, I wonder if Sundance will have it. They probably won't. I've been trying to, and it's just frustrating because I'll get to it and it's sold out, or it has that time thing anyway, where I'm like, even if I could have bought it, I still wouldn't have had time to watch it because I still have to, you know, work through this period, and I won't be done with the movie in time to get. So I would only have time to watch like 30 minutes of this movie that I would spend, what, 20, 30 bucks to watch, mm-hmm. at least. So yeah, I'm gonna have to check on some of the sites where I watch Game of Thrones. See if they have something. No, I'm not. We don't support pirating on this podcast, only for movies that you can't watch that are available to you. Anyway, Mank is available on Netflix. You can watch Mank right now. It's a great movie, and it's I don't know if it's Fincher's best, but it most certainly is one of his most intriguing and probably one of his most personal, if I will add. And it's only personal because Fincher always has seemed like an anti-capitalistic director, you know, going back to like Fight Club and Social Network. Even, you know, his punk rock days, you know, leading into The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And for him to make this movie that's like, you know, fuck Hollywood and fuck these people. It just seems like the most rebellious thing. And then to wrap it in 1940s, you know, 1940s aesthetic is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And personal. So anyway, I like the movie. I liked it a lot. David, do you have any more things to say on Mank?
I don't know. I love nice picture. Great movie. Mm-hmm. Like you said, I mean, it's a very interesting addition to Fincher's filmography. And I'll be curious to revisit it later down on the line. But yeah, I really loved it. I think I loved the approach stylistically of making it as though it was an older movie. And then the story at its center was very fascinating to me.
Yeah. Dave, Fincher, don't take 6 years to make another movie. Please don't. We miss your work. We're hungry for your work. Please don't take six more. Did you even watch Mindhunter?
No, I have not. I was struggling to try and cram as much of his filmography before this as I could, and I didn't have time for it. I do want to watch it at some point. I will watch it, even though I know it's kind of canceled or whatever, but I heard it was incredible.
That's what I keep hearing. I hear that, well, it might get canceled more because Fincher didn't realize how exhausting it would be to run a TV show. And if you run a TV show the way Fincher runs a movie, I can see how it can be like overwhelming, even for a seasoned vet like Fincher. But yeah, that's one of the reasons it's been on my queue for about 3 years now. So I probably should watch it, and I've heard many good things.
I find series very overwhelming because there's so many of them. It's hard to choose what to watch. Like, and like so many of them are like heralded as so great. It's just like overwhelming to choose. Whereas a movie, I don't know. I find it easier to watch new movies versus new series.
Mm-hmm. It's getting worse because I don't know if you remember Cary Fukunaga's mini series, The Maniac. Or Manic with Jonah Hill and Emma Stone.
I watched like the first episode, but then I never watched the rest of it.
I've never seen an episode, but I love Cary Fukunaga. So, and I've been waiting for Bond, you know, to come out, obviously, but.
Oh man, I want to see that so bad.
Yeah, so I'm kind of just like, well, I guess, you know, it's been 6 years since or 5 years really since Beasts of No Nation. So, and I think that's my thing. It's like, you're right, Siri. And the problem is our favorite filmmakers keep making series or they keep being a part of them. Like I've had Twin Peaks on my radar for a very long time. I still haven't watched it, but everyone tells me it's like the best show ever. So
I haven't watched it yet either. I keep hearing the same thing.
Yeah, I need to do better. I need to do better than just, you know, oh, I can just watch another episode of Rick and Morty. So I need to do better. Anyway, with that, David, do you have a blog?
Yeah, I do. It's called Film Assessment. I have a review for Mank there, and I actually just posted a review for Wonder Woman 1984 a few days ago, if you want to go read that.
Yeah, I'll have a link to that blog in the description. Please check it out. I am also very curious about Wonder Woman 1984, so I'll be reading that review. So, yes. And then you can find me on Twitter at MovieKale. That's where you'll get all the updates for this podcast. Listeners, first of all, thank you for listening. If you've listened to all 200 episodes and the retrospectives and all the other just whatever extra stuff I've done over the years, thank you so much. And David, thank you so much for being on the show. Especially these last few podcasts where we've just talked nothing but Tenet, the falling of movie theaters, Netflix movies, the falling of more movie theaters. But yes, thank you all for listening. We will have more and more content. We're still doing retrospectives right now. I don't know when this episode is coming out in relation to the other retrospectives, but we have just a lot more coming. And next week, we will definitely be talking about Soul and maybe Wonder Woman 1984. We'll just see. Thank you, David. We'll be back next week with something. It's just got a month.
LB, this is my brother, Joe.
Nice to meet you, Joseph.
Walk with me. What makes me cry? Emotion. Where do I feel emotion? Here, here, and here.
Aw, nerds.
What's nerds?
Nerds is Brooklynese for nuts.
Jeepers.
I expect more of you.
Mank. Mr. Mankiewicz.
Action!
Help!
Help! Herman Mankiewicz.